This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is The Money on RN, or wherever you get your podcasts. Richard Addy with you. Kleptocrats hiding their money, especially in Britain. We'll hear about that later. We begin with insurance, the insurance we need for disasters. The industry body says the East Coast floods have now led to 118,000 claims with an estimated cost of $1.77 billion. It's a huge amount, but it won't be nearly enough to put everything back together again because we have an insurance affordability problem. Too many of us can't afford the premiums and so aren't covered. Antonia Settle is at the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research.
The ACCC released a report in 2020. They found that the cost of insurance in Northern Australia was $2,500 a year, and in the rest of Australia, it's $1,400. These are averages. So what we're seeing is in Northern Australia, where there's significant cyclone risk, those insurance premiums are much higher.
So is the consequence of that that we have a percentage of people who just aren't insured?
Absolutely. We have significant underinsurance and significant non-insurance. So that's households who have dropped their insurance or have chosen to only insure up to a certain level because that's what they can afford. The ACCC cast about some figures. They were talking about basically double the amount of non-insurance in Northern Australia compared to the rest of the country. They were talking about those figures being something like 20% of households, but there is no good data on this, so it's very difficult to say. But I think we can all agree that the problem is much worse than anyone's expected.
Yeah. And of course, as you've already mentioned, premiums are going up and they're going to go up again, aren't they, with the floods that we've seen and are seeing in Queensland and New South Wales?
Oh, absolutely. So with this disaster that we're seeing unfolding at the moment, this is going to be extremely expensive for insurers and that's going to ratchet up the cost of premiums for households.
All right, we've got a problem. So what is the government actually doing?
At the moment, there's some legislation that's sitting before Parliament and it's called the reinsurance pool. So there's been a number of inquiries into how to manage this insurance crisis in Northern Australia because that's where we've seen it be the biggest problem. What the government has done to respond to that, they released a policy in the budget last year, which is a $10 billion a cyclone and flood damage reinsurance pool. And the idea there is that the government can drive down insurance costs for consumers by stepping in and acting as wholesaler in the reinsurance market. So the reinsurance market provides insurance to insurers. So the idea is that once you get to a certain threshold, once insurers are paying out to households to a certain threshold, beyond that, they can claim on their insurance provided by the state. So reinsurance caps the cost of insurance payouts for insurers.
So the idea is that it's there to provide kind of subsidised reinsurance to the insurers.
That's right. So by providing cheaper insurance, reinsurance to the insurers, the idea is that insurers will then be able to pass on that discount, pass on lower premiums to households.
Right. So what are the issues around that then?
So the concern is, and this is a concern that's been raised by the ACCC, the concern is that a reinsurance pool exposes the government to very high costs, up to $10 billion a year, but that the benefit is unclear. It's unclear how much of a benefit we're going to see from this policy, whether households are actually going to see cheaper premiums and whether the right households are going to see cheaper premiums or whether insurance companies are not going to pass on that discount at all.
Right. And as I understand it, Lismore, which is very much the focus of disaster in New South Wales, it wouldn't be covered by this anyway, because although it's in northern New South Wales, it's not in northern Australia.
That's right. It's not in northern Australia. And the other issue is that it wasn't a cyclone flood. So the only floods that are covered in the reinsurance pool are floods that follow cyclones.
So as far as you're concerned, and the ACCC, and I think the insurance industry are pretty agreed on this, that the government should be doing things like public works, building of levees, upgrading stormwater channels, and helping to improve buildings.
That's right. And part of the disappointment around this legislation is that we've had this inquiry coming from the ACCC, and stakeholders had a chance to make submissions to that inquiry. And in those submissions, the community sector didn't support reinsurance, and neither did industry, and neither did the ACCC. So to see 10 years of task forces and investigations into how to manage this problem, to see reinsurance being the legislation that comes out of that process, even though there was no support for reinsurance from any stakeholders, is really quite disappointing.
Yes. Now, I understand that in some countries, there has been examples of what's called a managed retreat. Now, what is that exactly?
A managed retreat is about governments buying up properties in the most climatically vulnerable regions and returning them to nature. So buying properties from households, supporting those households to resettle in safer areas, and then returning that location to, for example, floodplain, which in turn can support better natural defences against floods for a particular place.
Where has this occurred?
We actually see this occurring to some degree in coastal regions in Western Europe, but particularly in the US and in Canada, we've seen managed retreat largely for flooding issues and also to some degree for coastal erosion, storm surge kind of issues.
As you say it, though, it occurs to me that this could work. It could work, of course it could, but it could also be fraught with problems.
So certainly it's very much emotionally charged. It's very difficult for residents and for them to be moved on. And sometimes it's voluntary, sometimes it's not. There also can be quite long delays. So a policy like this can take quite a lot of time to actually come to fruition. There's also really problematic financial implications. So certainly for those households who are subject to managed retreat, there can be disagreement about how much the government is going to pay to those households for those houses, which comes to the crux of the issue, really. It's about the value of housing. The other problem with managed retreat is that it affects property values in neighbouring regions. So in many places, we see communities trying to shut down debate about managed retreat because they don't want their house prices affected by the fact that the suburb next over to them has been deemed effectively uninhabitable and worthless.
It's a Pandora's box, isn't it? You can see the intention behind it, but you can see how problematic it could be. We're going to have to face up to climate change more squarely than we have in terms of what it means for our housing and where we have it, aren't we?
Well, that's right. And that's exactly why it's a really tricky issue. What we're starting to see already is that markets are starting to price in climate risk. So we see that, for example, in rising premiums. Households in particularly climatic vulnerable regions where they're seeing recurrent disasters, insurance premiums are ratcheting up and making the everyday costs of housing very, very expensive. Now, at the same time, if those households want to move, they're going to find that the value of their houses has dropped significantly. So we're already seeing changes in house values that are reflecting climate risk. The economic fallout is obviously potentially really dangerous. Mm. For many households, their retirement savings is sitting in that asset in their homes. Huge amounts of debt rest on the collateral of home. So if we see rapid changes in value, we can really see quite significant financial disruption as well as social disruption. So one thing that's really important, I think, to be mindful of is that we have the potential to see wealthier households with more resources leaving these climatically vulnerable regions that can leave behind low-income households. And we really face a really difficult problem where we already start to see this. So already in Lismore, in the wake of the 2017 flood, 80% of households in the flood zone were from the lowest socioeconomic quintile. So already the cheapest housing is in the most climatically vulnerable regions. And we really need to make sure that that trend doesn't go any further.
That's confronting, isn't it? The idea that climate change-driven disaster is actually making inequality worse. Antonia Settles, McKinsey Postdoctoral Fellow at the Melbourne Institute. And this is The Money with me, Richard Adie. Oil prices have gone through the roof. If you fill up a car, you don't need me to tell you that. And the other day, the US announced it will no longer buy oil, gas or coal from Russia as a result of that country's invasion of Ukraine. That decision doesn't affect us directly, but as Vlado Vovoda, who's at Deakin University, explains, Australia's still vulnerable to further price shocks.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything is connected. It's like what it can be compared to one big pool, where it doesn't really matter who exactly is producing, who is consuming. So it's a connected, very mature market that's gone through a lot of upheaval in the past, ups and downs. And particularly for countries that are dependent on imports, you end up being exposed to those changes in global prices. So this, for example, the case in Australia.
Yes. I was just saying, because everyone who buys petrol can see the prices have gone up. Indeed, I think yesterday I heard it compared to the second oil crisis at the end of the 70s. Is that a realistic assessment?
Oh, yes. Look, I think the prices in real terms are actually higher now than they were back then. Particularly back then, Australia was probably not importing much. Australia was fairly insulated from what was going on. But I think the oil market now is a lot more mature than it was in the 70s. There are a lot more safety mechanisms in place, a lot more suppliers as well, mm-hmm. and buyers. So there are ways to, as well for importers to manipulate and impact on the price. So for example, it was following the 1970s oil crisis that the International Energy Agency was formed to counter OPEC. That's when they implemented a requirement, for example, for member states, and this is the OECD countries, to have a strategic petroleum reserves, 90 days requirements of imports, so that they can then release in times exactly like this.
Well, hang on. Can I ask about that? Because as I understand it,
sure. We
have fuel reserves, but we don't have them here. They're in America. And I don't know if we have anything like 90 days worth.
No, we don't. It's equivalent to about 2 days of Australia's demand. We're about 3 days worth of imports at most, and it doesn't really make much of a difference.
Yes, I'd be reluctant to put the word strategic in front of reserve when you've only got 2 or 3 days supply. Just before we move to gas, can we expect petrol prices to go higher for Australian motorists?
I would say with international oil prices at about $130 a barrel, where they have been over the past few days, so they've gone down somewhat.
Mm.
I think that we'll get petrol prices at about $2.10, $2.15 a litre at a bowser. This takes about a week or two to actually be felt at a bowser. So I do think that we'll get a bit higher prices still before they may go down.
Yeah.
And then depends. They can go further up. It really depends on what the developments with regards to oil sanctions are.
Indeed.
Whether European countries follow suit with the Americans, what happens with other suppliers, whether OPEC decides to increase their production. So I would say, yes, they will go a bit higher, but hopefully not too much higher.
All right, let's talk about natural gas. I understand the pricing of that's completely different. It's based on contracts made with individual companies. You actually say that gas is the bigger problem. Why is that?
Look, gas is the bigger problem because unlike oil, which is easily replaceable and can be easily transported, gas is either moved, and majority of natural gas is moved internationally through pipelines, which ends up in situations where, you know, countries are locked into certain supply route due to infrastructure being there. Or alternatively, have these expensive LNG terminals, which are used to liquefy natural gas and then get shipped to a receiving port where the gas is regasified. And because this infrastructure is very expensive to build, it's usually funded and based on these long-term contracts that suppliers sign with buyers. and they get locked into these for 10 or 15 years. And with pipelines, it's obvious you can't move a pipeline. That's why a lot of, first and foremost, a lot of European countries are still locked in with Russian gas.
Yes, yes.
And they have no alternatives. There is no other way to bring that gas. Some of them are landlocked countries like Slovakia, Hungary, Austria. This is why gas prices in Europe some days have traded to, say, an equivalent of about $600 a barrel in oil. For the same amount of energy, the price was $600 a barrel equivalent. And not because Russian gas has stopped flowing. It's still going because the Russians needed money and the Europeans need the gas. The winter is still on there. But because of the potential for sanctions here, and that would lead to real shortages.
But at the moment, of course, the Europeans are effectively paying for the invasion of Ukraine because they're paying so much for gas.
You could argue that, yeah. You could absolutely argue that because they just cannot rid themselves of that dependence on Russian gas in the short term. I have seen the International Energy Agency putting forward a 10-point plan for the European Union to reduce imports of Russian gas by a third. And then the European Union came out last couple of days arguing that they are going to implement a plan to cut Russian gas by two-thirds, which is, I don't know how realistic it is.
Yes, and it's not going to happen quickly, that's for sure. The fossil fuel companies, you've probably noticed this too, have been quick to say that this war affects our transition away from carbon. How do you see it?
I think that we need to separate a couple of different things here. So one is energy security and another one is decarbonization. I think it's extremely important that, you know, energy security concerns that countries get enough energy, including fossil fuel energy, as much as they need. But at the same time, we need to equally pursue the goal of decarbonization. They really need to be pursued concurrently. I do think that higher prices and this overall supply issue with Russia is going to encourage a lot of countries to switch to alternative energies a bit quicker.
Might make more sense to encourage the growth of the electric car market, to be honest.
Absolutely, because you're then addressing decarbonization and energy security at the same time. So you're cutting your reliance on imported oil, and we are at the mercy of international markets, but also you're encouraging a shift to possibly renewable energies because we are so far behind there. We only got, I think, 2% of new car sales. Electric vehicles compared with, which is less even than the United States, for example, and let alone Europe. So there's a lot of ground to be gained for Australia. And my view is that we just bear the brunt of these prices and push for greater penetration of low emissions vehicles.
That is where we have to leave it. But thank you very much, Vlado Vovoda, for joining us today on The Money.
You're welcome, Richard. Thank you.
Vlado Vovoda lectures in strategic studies at Deakin University. He's at the Australian War College in Canberra. The economic and financial sanctions against Russia include the targeting of some extremely wealthy individuals with political connections, the oligarchs. Most have vast assets outside of Russia, in the US and Europe, but most particularly the UK. And the scale of this has been documented most recently in a Chatham House report, The UK's Kleptocracy Problem. Its lead author is John Heathershaw.
Unfortunately, Britain's efforts have been rather less effective than other countries, certainly than the United States, the European Union and Switzerland. There's been a lot of talk from the government about introducing sanctions on oligarchs, but they've recently had to change the law again to try and make it easier to place those sanctions. I think the real problem is that they don't know where the money is, they don't know where the investments are, and that's because of the system of financial secrecy, which in the past has allowed people to keep property and companies and the like without full disclosure of the beneficial owner. So that means for the UK government, it's really hard to know what they'll be sanctioning. And obviously that has a knock-on effect on the economy.
But I mean, it's only, what, less than a week ago that the British government was making noises about confiscating properties owned by oligarchs and making them available to house Ukrainian refugees. So that was kind of what, bread and circuses.
Well, it's a crisis, so the government needs to be seen to act. And it seems the government likes to announce things before it knows it has the capacity to do things. So what happened was you had EU countries confiscating yachts and properties, whereas the very same individuals weren't even sanctioned yet by the UK. So I think that speaks to sort of chronic structural problems within the system, where we're not sure of some of the legal impediments in place, and we're fearful of big London lawyers who represent these people who might be able to push back.
Well, you unpack with colleagues a great deal of this in a Chatham House paper, which was published at the end of last year, called The UK's Kleptocracy Problem. Briefly, what is the problem?
Well, kleptocracy, which is not necessarily a familiar term to everyone, is a form of rule where political and economic power are fused, that if you're successful in business, you also have links to politics. If you're in politics, you probably have a great deal of wealth. And so you get a political economy dominated by a small number of people. And it's easy to think that problem would just be located in a place like Russia or Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan, or where you have that kind of system of government. But the reality is that if you're wealthy in Kazakhstan, you're not just wealthy in Kazakh tenge, which is the national currency there, but you want that money in dollars, and you want some of the goods that make you a global elite. So that means property in a hotspot like London or Geneva or Los Angeles. And you want to acquire the rights to residency there, bank accounts there, a property there, as I say, and you need to build up a reputation there. So you might want to make donations to philanthropy, and you establish yourself, you give yourself a kind of bolt hole. And that's actually really strongly connected to the form of rule, because kleptocratic systems are unstable. The kind of key business people, the oligarchs among them, will typically fear for their position. And so they do want this way out. But also they just need to do things like their big companies, they need to float them on somewhere like the London Stock Exchange and raise money for them that way. And so the UK's kleptocracy problem is basically the fact that the UK has been willing to service all these needs without doing proper checks and without holding these persons to account for the sources of their wealth.
Do we know how much illicit money has been made respectable in the UK?
We can't give an overall answer to that question. So we can say, for example, that in our study, which we published in Chatham House, we were able to identify £2 billion worth of London property from the post-Soviet states, which had been cleaned up because those property purchases went through. We're able to see who owns what. That's usually really, really hard to do. So it took our team a lot of research to link properties to persons. So that money's been cleaned up. That's been cleaned up through property. But that is the tip of the iceberg, because we know there's something like 80,000 properties, mainly high-value properties in London, owned through offshore companies. Some of those might be sort of big celebrities who want to have their property remain secret and not on the land registry. But in many cases, it'll be what we call politically exposed persons from kleptocratic states.
None of this happens, of course, without help. Who are the enablers, John, the people, the groups that benefit from doing this for the kleptocrats?
London is one of the global centres, if not the global centre, for legal services to a global market. So we're talking about lawyers across certain sectors. That might be in the sector of reputation management, which include things like the defamation. It could be just in sort of corporate law, really, and mergers and acquisitions and flotations on the stock market, property law as well, and overseeing transactions, high-value transactions into real estate. So legal enablers are crucial. They're a regulated sector. They are supposed to do due diligence checks, but that appears to have been a problem in the past based on their claim that, they offer confidentiality to their clients and everyone has the right to legal services, whoever you are. So you've got big companies in the UK that, very large companies, very influential in Britain. It's their partners that sit on law society panels when a reform of the law is being proposed. And they are some of the big companies that are offering services to these clients. You've got enablers in other sectors as well, whether it's real estate agents or bankers or company formation agents. There's a variety of them. But I think lawyers are really, really powerful and really, really significant in the UK context.
So why does this matter? Is it that they have, the kleptocrats have a kind of corrosive effect on British institutions, even British democracy?
Yes, I think that is the principal reason for the UK to deal with this problem. We can see that the efficiency and the effectiveness of the rule of law is being damaged because all the chips are with those that have money and power. And the law seems to be written in a way to advantage them. The laws in the past, they're starting to change now, but they've allowed this kind of secrecy, which just makes it incredibly difficult to find out what's going on. Mm. And I think, you know, that the litmus test of this is the fact that when you look at a database like we have of property purchasers by kleptocrats, you find that the only people at risk at all of finding that their property will be seized or confiscated are political exiles, and not those who are incumbents in power. Mm. And what that effectively means is that the kleptocracies themselves are able to manipulate British law and ensure that it's their enemies who are subject to it whilst they are free from it.
Yes.
And that's not the rule of law at all. So there's that core problem. But I think there's a second problem which speaks to the international security questions of leaving yourself open to this kind of influence and allowing regimes like Russia to build up wealth partly through these connections, which then enables them to do things like what we've seen with the invasion of Ukraine. It's a small part of the picture, but it is a part of the picture. Mm.
Now, John, what is your estimation of how interested the British government is in pursuing this sort of approach?
Well, there's been a lot of talk over the last few months after the Kazakhstan crisis and now Russia and Ukraine. We've had an economic crime bill rushed through Parliament, which has made some changes that have been called for years and years, that the government promised 6 years ago, that it began to introduce to Parliament 4 years ago. So the basic answer to that question is, in the past, very little, lots of talk, no action. Recently, we've seen serious action, some of which is really positive, significant reforms like bringing in a proper system for a public register of properties, which has been long needed and is now coming through. But it has to come with this wider structural change. Now, that's been promised too, because there'll be a white paper following on from the current economic crime bill. There'll be a second economic crime bill to address this. And so those of us who are involved in providing the evidence base and the big civil society organizations like Transparency International, Spotlight on Corruption, and these people, they're really trying to hold the government's feet to the fire to make sure these are not hollow promises, that there won't be sort of big loopholes carved out. So the government claims it's interested, but there's often a very big gap between rhetoric and reality with the current government, I'm afraid. So we will believe it once we see not just the law passed in Parliament, this second law, but when we begin to see the case law be achieved, whereby you can see proper enforcement actions by the National Crime Agency and convictions in the courts, including of the enablers who have been turning a blind eye to obvious evidence of corruption on the part of their clients.
Yes, that will be a very profound and important change. John, thank you very much for joining us today.
No problem at all. It's a pleasure.
Professor John Heathershaw from the University of Exeter. And that's it for this week. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. Our sound engineer is Emrys Cronin. I'm Richard Addy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.